From Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship, this is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, December 9, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. A military judge is set to hear the case of Army Chaplain James Yee. We take a look at the Florida State Democratic Convention. And another controversial trade agreement, CAFTA, is set to be finalized this week. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. AIDS activists blocked a main artery of downtown D.C. this afternoon, hoping to bring attention to what they call the negative impact the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA, will have on AIDS drugs. Jenny Johnson reports from D.C.
Eight people were arrested for locking down in the streets of D.C. this afternoon to protest the effects of CAFTA on people living with AIDS. Four of the six Latin American countries with the highest HIV rates are in Central America. Organizers said CAFTA will strengthen patent protections on AIDS drugs.
That's what this CAFTA agreement is trying to prevent. More affordable generic medicines would be available if countries in Central America didn't have to buy name brand drugs from rich American pharmaceutical companies.
Pharmaceutical companies' profits will go up, as will the number of AIDS deaths in Central America, they said.
CAFTA equals death!
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jenny Johnson.
A former Nicaraguan president was found guilty of corruption while he was in office. In Managua, Nan McCurdy reports.
Arnaldo Alemán was found guilty on December 7th of crimes committed during his presidential administration, including money laundering, fraud, and the abuse of public funds. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison and fines of twice the amount stolen. Until this month, the Sandinistas and President Bolaños have been cooperating on many items of national interest. This ended when Secretary of State Colin Powell visited Nicaragua in early November. Powell told the Nicaraguan president to end relations with the Sandinista Party. He also told Bolaños and his small fraction of National Assembly deputies to unite with the majority liberal constitutional deputies led by ex-president Arnaldo Alemán. He told them in no uncertain terms to unite in order to beat the Sandinistas in future elections. From Managua, Nicaragua, for Free Speech Radio News, this is Nan McCurdy.
Today, presidential candidate Howard Dean received a huge nod from Democratic Party insider, former Vice President Al Gore, at a Harlem fundraiser. Josh Chaffin reports from New York.
It's a blow to many candidates in the Democratic field who've lately been trying to knock Dean off of his national lead. Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman claims to have been caught off guard by Gore's endorsement of Dean. While Gore's 2000 running mate was in favor of the Iraq War, Gore said today Dean was the only Democratic candidate who made the correct judgment about the war, coming out against it. With Gore's announcement, Dean will likely enjoy some surge in support from mainstream Democrats. Some key Gore operatives have announced they'll go to work on the Dean campaign. The first of the presidential caucuses is set for January 19th in Iowa. Josh Chaffin in New York City for Free Speech Radio News.
The leader of a gang of skinheads has been sentenced in Portland, Oregon to 3 years for his part in the city's race-based violence. From KBOO in Portland, Andrew Stelzer reports.
Brian Houth was the leader of a racist skinhead gang called the Oregon State Boot Boys. He pleaded guilty to charges of a civil rights conspiracy for recruiting teenage boys to burn crosses at a Jewish cemetery and spray-paint graffiti on a Korean church. Randy Blazak is a professor at Portland State and the author of the White Supremacists and Skinheads entries in the Encyclopedia of Terrorism. Blazak has spoken with Houth several times, including after he was sentenced.
The problem is he's being sent to Sheridan Federal Penitentiary, where there are very powerful, organized white supremacist gangs. So if he wants to kind of leave this life behind, he's going to have a really hard time.
The Boot Boys are just one of many racist skinhead groups in Portland, and this crime did not happen in isolation. 3 months ago, an African-American man was stabbed in the back by two self-described skinheads on the streets of Portland. For FSRN, from Portland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
The Texas state-sponsored execution by lethal injection causes painful and protracted death, according to a new lawsuit. Renee Feltz reports from KPFT in Houston.
Filed in Southern Federal District Court late Monday, it names as plaintiffs the three men scheduled for execution this week. The suit alleges the lethal mixture injected into prisoners contains two sedating chemicals that essentially cancel each other out, and a third that paralyzes the prisoner's muscles. Witnesses to executions may, in short, be watching a man forced into a chemical straitjacket and gag as he lay silently while chemicals ravage his internal organs. This method of euthanasia is banned for pets in at least 19 states, including Texas. Plaintiffs in the lawsuit request protection under the Eighth Amendment, barring cruel and unusual punishment, and the 14th Amendment, affording equal protection under the law. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The Republican chair of the House Ethics Committee said today he would consider an investigation if a formal complaint is filed into an alleged bribe of $100,000 for an affirmative vote on the Medicare bill. Republican Congressmember Nick Smith said after the contentious and close vote that unnamed GOP aides offered his son's congressional campaign money if Smith changed his vote. Smith said he did not accept the money and he did not change his vote, but under heat from his own party, Smith has since backed down from the bribery allegation. Democratic congressional leaders, however, are still urging for an investigation. Meanwhile, as former Vice President Al Gore has endorsed Howard Dean for the Democratic presidential nomination, the Democratic candidates are readying themselves for tonight's debate in New Hampshire. Over the weekend, many of the candidates spoke and fielded questions at Florida's State Democratic Convention. Mitch Jeserich has this report.
The Florida State Democratic Convention was held over the weekend at the Disney World Resort. The candidates were proclaiming their work to a state that is seen as pivotal in next year's presidential elections. Senator John Kerry told the Florida delegates that he'll undo many of President Bush's executive orders.
I'm going to reverse every executive order that was ideologically put in place by George Bush on the gag rule, on the environment, on workers, on ergonomics, on workers' rights.
Kerry, along with the rest of the candidates, accused President Bush of placing a for sale sign on the White House lawn. The Democratic candidates, however, are not without their major contributors as well. They all have received large contributions from trial lawyers, labor unions, and corporations. Kerry's second top contributor is Citigroup, the world's largest bank, and who is leading the lobbying charge on Capitol Hill to deny consumers the right to financial privacy. Celia Wexler with Common Cause says following the money that candidates receives can be revealing.
Companies are not dopes. They give for a reason. They give to ensure the fact that they will be able to make their case where power is in the best possible way. They want to have the ability to get close to the person in power. That's the way the game is played in Washington, especially among corporations.
Since 1984, candidates who have raised the most money just before the primaries have won the nominations. Candidate Howard Dean has raised the most money with over $25 million this year, and he has announced he will not accept federal matching funds. By using the internet, Dean's campaign says the majority of the money has come in contributions smaller than $100. Dean's motto has been that he represents the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party.
The way we're going to beat George Bush is not to be Bush Light. It's to reach out to the 50% of Americans in this country who have given up on voting because they can't tell the difference between the parties anymore and give them a reason to vote.
However, Dean has corporate donors as well. While Dean states the importance of his party to differentiate itself from the Republicans, one of his top contributors is Microsoft, who actually donates more money to the Republicans. Other top Dean contributors include IBM and the media conglomerate Time Warner. Again, Celia Wexler with Common Cause.
We already know that Mr. Dean is gone to Hollywood to raise money. That in of itself is not terrible, but we know that, you know, when it comes, for example, to issues like media consolidation, some of the powers that be in Hollywood have certain concerns about that. They would like to see the ability for media mergers to happen.
The top corporate contributor for candidate and congressional member Dennis Kucinich is the bookstore chain Borders. Kucinich is running on a progressive agenda that includes handing Iraq over to the UN, including the contracts for rebuilding the country.
That Pentagon budget is out of whack. They're spending money hand over fist. They've got $1 trillion in accounts they can't even reconcile. I say we can cut that budget by 15% and put that money right into a universal pre-kindergarten program for our children.
Candidate and former Senator and Ambassador Karen Mosley Braun's top contributor is the engineering corporation MWH Americas that works on projects worldwide. Mosley Braun opposed the invasion of Iraq, but now she suggests the U.S. cannot leave quickly.
Americans don't cut and run. And so we have to see this misadventure through to a noble conclusion. The sacrifice of those who lost their lives in the sands of Iraq will not be forgotten, but neither will the folly of preemptive war.
Arguably, the most progressive candidates, Mosley Braun, Kucinich, and Sharpton, are not doing well in either the polls or in fundraising. In fact, the economist Lyndon LaRouche has raised more money in his candidacy than each of them. LaRouche's top contributor is the defense contractor Lockheed Martin. I'm Mitch Jezerich for Free Speech Radio News.
President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe has announced his country's withdrawal from the group of nations called the Commonwealth. The move is to protest a decision made at the weekend's Commonwealth Summit in Nigeria to suspend Zimbabwe indefinitely for human rights violations and lack of political reforms. But human rights groups say the Commonwealth is acting hypocritically by targeting Zimbabwe, adding that the summit should not have been held in Nigeria on account of Nigeria's poor human rights record. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
Queen Elizabeth II, the official head of the Commonwealth, opened the Commonwealth Summit last week in Nigeria's capital of Abuja.
The theme of your meeting, Development and Democracy, Partnership for Peace and Prosperity, captures imperatives that are central to the Commonwealth. Democracy gives people a choice in how they are governed, and those in government rule with the consent of their people.
The 54-nation Commonwealth is made up of Britain and its former colonies. Commonwealth leaders agreed to an indefinite suspension of Zimbabwe on account of poor human rights records and a lack of democratic reforms. Zimbabwe has pulled out of the body in protest. Commonwealth spokesman Joel Kibazo says in suspending Zimbabwe indefinitely, the body acted in good faith.
This decision was meant to help the return of Zimbabwe to the Commonwealth. Zimbabwe took its own decision, but I don't know how increased isolation is going to help the people of Zimbabwe, which after all is what the Commonwealth was trying to do, to help the people of Zimbabwe, and we still care about Zimbabwe.
But human rights groups are accusing the Commonwealth of double standards. They say the regime of Nigeria's President Olusegun Obasanjo is just as guilty as that of Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe. Bamidele Aturu is a Lagos-based human rights activist.
And you have a government that is undemocratic in character and nature, and you have a government also that is alleged by the opposition to have rigged election. That allegation is there. The matter is still being challenged in the tribunals. So why would you then allow this kind of administration to host the Commonwealth when you are accusing Zimbabwe of the same crimes?
The Commonwealth says Nigeria hosted this year's summit as an endorsement of the reforms the country has made since President Obasanjo came to power 5 years ago. His regime ended 15 years of military rule that was characterized by human rights violations, which led to the country's suspension from the Commonwealth in 1995. After the execution of the playwright Ken Saro-Wiwa. But human rights groups say President Obasanjo has not made significant reforms beyond what he inherited from his military predecessors. Bamidele Aturu says by taking the summit to Nigeria, the Commonwealth has created a credibility problem for itself.
I'm saying that the Commonwealth has a credibility problem in the sense that we have a government in Nigeria that has very bad records in terms of the protection of the human rights of the people of Nigeria. There are gross violations of the human rights of the people.
Killings, arrests, and detentions of government opponents are some of the cases of gross human rights violations cited by the US-based group Human Rights Watch in a report the body issued to coincide with Nigeria's hosting of the Commonwealth Summit. Nigerian human rights activists say even though Nigeria, unlike Zimbabwe, came out unscratched from the Commonwealth Summit, the human rights situation in the country has been significantly highlighted to keep Nigeria under the focus of the international community. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
Amid much controversy, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA, is scheduled to be finalized this week in Washington, D.C. Selena Masuda has this report.
The Central American Free Trade Agreement, also known as CAFTA, will enter into its final round of negotiations in downtown Washington, D.C. from December the 8th to the 16th. Various organizations are planning a series of actions in front of the Mayflower Hotel, where the talks are taking place. Critics of CAFTA say that the agreement protects corporations and governments rather than the working class. Sunday was the first protest of the week against CAFTA in Washington, D.C. Opponents of CAFTA say that the agreement will flood Central American markets with United States goods, while wages remain the same or driven down. Leda Molina from El Salvador explains the economic hardships that El Salvadorans face.
You're looking at all these products that are being pushed in that they're paying in dollars, their wages are not going up. When you could buy, let's say, a mango for 25 cents de pesos, you're now they're charging you a dollar. It's just pushing the prices of products, and not only that, you no longer can find really Salvadoran products. Everything is imported. You name it, from deodorant to toothpaste. There is no development for the small business owner.
Thea Lee, international economist of the AFL-CIO, says that protecting workers' rights in Central American countries is not a provision in the agreement.
A lot of workers really don't have the right to form an independent union. They can be jailed or fired. We, the AFL-CIO, have asked for workers' rights protections in trade agreements, and yet what the Bush administration has put forward is very, very weak, and even the enforcement provisions that they proposed are likely to be pretty ineffective.
Union organizer Julie Eisenberg argues that CAFTA is an extension of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which has decimated the Mexican economy and has affected immigration into the states.
Immigrants have had to come to the United States since NAFTA was implemented 10 years ago. The reason is because NAFTA has essentially destroyed the Mexican economy. The number of remittances that are actually getting sent back from the United States to Mexico this year, historically the highest ever, even despite the attempts to close off the border. When we look at CAFTA, when we look at the FTAA and any of the other free trade agreements that the United States is trying to impose on the hemisphere, all that's going to do is create the same poverty.
Under trade agreements like CAFTA, to Andean trade preference action comes increased militarism, says Mario from Colombia.
Yo creo que la relación es una sola, es la intención de poder controlar un área.
Both CAFTA and Plan Colombia correspond to a plan by the U.S. government, a strategy of the U.S. government to control these areas in Latin America, control the resources, dominate the areas. You got Plan Colombia, Plan Puebla, Panama, the Andean Pact region, and they're all different programs by the United States government to dominate either economically or militarily these countries and these regions. So they're very much connected in that strategy.
Joshua Woodbury, a research associate for the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, says that the driving force behind CAFTA is control of resources by the U.S. Woodbury says that the United States recertified Guatemala to receive U.S. aid despite their lack of enforcement on the drug trade.
There has not been any improvement whatsoever in drug seizures in Guatemala. The Bush administration recertified Guatemala on September 15th because they know that the CAFTA negotiations would not be able to proceed without the largest economy and population in Central America. So they've basically shown that they're willing to put aside drug issues and possibly human rights in an effort to promote free trade.
Because the Bush administration reapproved a fast-track trade negotiation process last year, when CAFTA is introduced into the House and Senate, Congress will only have 90 days to approve or reject with no ability to make amendments. Activists ask that people contact their representatives to vote no to CAFTA. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Selena Masuda.
The case against U.S. Army Chaplain James Yee, like many in the post-9/11 environment, has been one of guilty until proven innocent. The U.S. Army levels highly inflammatory charges against the Muslim Chinese-American chaplain, yet is withholding evidence of these charges. The accused has been denied access to legal counsel and visits with his family. Chaplain Yi, who ministered to detainees at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, was initially charged in September with espionage. He was shackled in leg irons and held in solitary confinement for 76 days. The charges were later changed to mishandling classified material and then changed again upon Yi's release. Martha Baskin reports that this week a military judge will hear Chaplain Yi's case.
After Yi's release from solitary confinement, his attorney, Jean Fidel, received a packet of evidence from the Army. A few days later, the Army decided the evidence was classified and sent emissaries to retrieve the documents. Jean Fidel.
We're now faced with the situation where the government is prosecuting a chaplain for failing to, by their lights, properly safeguard what they think is classified information at a time when their own attorneys seem not to be properly safeguarding what they believe is classified information. There's a kind of paradox there, and it's the type of thing that, you know, if anybody had something other than a tin ear, they would say, why are we pursuing this prosecution?
The military's answers may be forthcoming during this week's hearing. To date, the government has refused to give Fidel a security clearance to review Yi's case. But it didn't take long for the Chinese-American and U.S.-based Muslim communities to conclude that the case against Yi is malicious harassment based on race and religion. Ibrahim Mohammed, chair of the Seattle chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations.
Here is a person that the Defense Department wanted to make an example of. They didn't even officially charge him, but they were good enough to leak to everybody that here is a potential spy, and you put him shackled hands and feet in solitary confinement. Why wasn't that done to anybody else in the past?
What makes Yi's case unique was his direct contact with detainees held at Guantanamo. Military authorities launched an investigation of Yi, a West Point graduate, after a series of confrontations over the treatment of Al-Qaeda and Taliban detainees. Some interrogators at the U.S. Navy prison complex complained that Yi's private one-on-one meetings with inmates interfered with their attempts to fully control the prisoners. Shortly thereafter, a story was leaked by an unnamed law enforcement official to the Washington Times, the influential right-wing paper owned by the Reverend Sun Yung Moon, that Yi was a spy. Again, Yi's attorney, Jean Fidel.
I am concerned that my client was smeared at the very beginning of this process. Some coward who works for the United States government permitted himself to be used as a source who said that my client was charged with espionage, aiding the enemy, and a variety of other very heinous offenses. The fact is, my client was never charged with any of those offenses.
Cecilia Chang and the nonprofit organization Justice for New Americans were at the forefront in confronting the government's false accusations against Los Alamos scientist Wenho Lee. The government's case against Army Captain James Yi, says Chang, is all too familiar. Alleged spy, later dropped. Trial by media. New charges. Chang speaks of the government's most recent charges against Yi, adultery and possession of pornography.
Okay? So I'm going to hurt you one way or the other. Character assassination, character discredit him. Is he going to be a... Can he really be a chaplain if somebody accuses him of adultery and not... If his name never get clear? I doubt it very much. His career is going down the drain.
And why is the U.S. government persistent in damaging the career and reputation of one of its own, an Army chaplain who expressed misgivings about the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo?
Well, the United States government is maintaining what is tantamount to a concentration camp at Guantanamo Bay.
Marjorie Cohn, law professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego and author of a forthcoming article on conditions at Guantanamo for Covert Action Quarterly.
And it's undisputed that nearly half the prisoners at Guantanamo are interrogated every week in sessions lasting up to 16 hours per session. There's a prisoner who was released in May who told Amnesty International that the interrogations were like torture. And a Pakistani minister filed a $10.4 million lawsuit against the U.S. government claiming that the wardens at Guantanamo used drugs that made us senseless.
Khan points out that given international and domestic outcry over the detention of prisoners, as well as the recent Supreme Court decision to review the legal status of those detained, the military appears to be on the defensive. Army Chaplain James Yi's military hearing is slated to conclude this week. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting.
People across the country are following the actions of the Massachusetts State Assembly, which was ordered by the state's Supreme Judicial Court to recognize the rights of gay and lesbian couples to marry by May. Members of Black, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities are mobilizing to express their perspectives. The National Black Justice Coalition initiated a new campaign yesterday to highlight an increased support in Black communities for marriage equality. From the DC Radio Co-op, Darby Hickey has this report.
As members of Congress test the waters of public opinion concerning a federal marriage amendment, Black community leaders from across the country gathered in downtown Washington on Monday to make their voices heard. Keith Boykin helped to found the National Black Justice Coalition.
Groups are already planning campaigns to deal with the issue of marriage equality, and it's important that the African-American community be involved in this as well. It's important that money be targeted to the African-American community and to the African-American media specifically, particularly because we're at the crux of the issue here. We're the ones who everybody wants to move. The right wing wants to move us one way, the left wing wants to move us the other way. We have an obligation to make sure that our community is part of this debate at all levels.
One goal of the campaign is to dispel the myth that Black communities are more homophobic than others. Many prominent Black leaders support lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights, but a few opponents have garnered all the media attention, said Donna Payne of the coalition.
The Congressional Black Caucus has been 100% supportive of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community, more than any of the other caucuses.
Maurice Franklin, another member of the coalition, said Black leaders who speak against rights for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people are being hypocritical.
We, as African Americans, have had to fight for everything that we've gotten in this country, and to abandon that once we feel like we've gotten a certain sense of the American dream is completely missing the mark on what I would call the moral compass that the civil rights community had to look at where we've come. We're 40 years from the Voting Rights Act. We're not too many years away from Jim Crow. And all of a sudden, we've got a piece of the American dream. We think that we have overcome a few things that we can begin to oppress our own and others. And so I really think it's a little short-sighted.
Coalition members said that marriage equality resonates with Black communities and made comparisons to the fight for interracial marriage. Others remembered the complete prohibition on Black marriage during the slave era. Love is what makes a family, said Reverend Michaela Moore.
I am also a parent raising two boys. My partner, we are saying loving. And we show these two boys the greatest love that they can ever have, which is unconditional love. And we will give that to them always, no matter what.
While including transgender people in their campaign, coalition members like Mandy Carter were short on details.
The conversation right now, especially in terms of state law, is also how do you include the transgender community? So it's not about excluding. The question is, how do we include? Also, I think maybe we need to stop saying orientation, but identity.
Many LGBT people see marriage as secondary to issues like employment and hate crimes. Keith Boykin is a member of the coalition who previously opposed prioritizing marriage rights.
Marriage is the big issue in the public and the media today, so we're going to have to address it, perhaps even with more resources than we would have used before. If we don't win this battle, we're going to lose a lot of other battles.
The National Black Justice Coalition plans to raise over $100,000 for spending on advertisement in Black media. They also will launch a website and continue to increase the visibility of Black support for marriage equality. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey. Thanks to Jasmine Fraser for help on this report.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. FSRN is a worker-run collective, and for more information, visit our website at www.fsrn.org.